Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Classes of Mail. My name is Alan Gigax, and today we get back to reading from the ELM. We're going to get through as much of the 900s as we can so that we can get on to other exciting stuff. And speaking of exciting stuff, boy, how about that last episode? Wasn't that something? Yeah, so I am running for vice president of my local union. As you obviously heard in that last episode, it was my plan to just run for steward and make sure I was secure there before I moved on. But I'll tell you, all this movements with the concerned letter carriers and, you know, learning more about the way our union is supposed to be run and the way our local is supposed to be run, I just can't sit on the sidelines. Plus, I was asked, would you like to be vice president? And yeah, I think I would. And I want to do what I can to help the carriers in Las Vegas. To that end, I have started another podcast that is called The Postal Stand-Up. And it's something that I've been talking about for quite a while, where I just want to do these five-minute, or where I think union leadership should do these five-minute talks, equivalent to the morning stand-up or the morning huddle, where we pass along information that is useful to you as a carrier, that reminds you of your rights, that gives you important tips, things like that. And I finally realized, like, oh, I should probably just be the change I want to see in the world. If I sit around and wait for our current local union leaders to do that, it's never going to happen. They have no interest. So that exists now. So go find that. It's called The Postal Stand-Up. And the first episode is out. Oh, that is for me. Just a sec. It should come as no surprise that that was a telemarketer. So, fooey on them for interrupting. So anyway, it's called Your Postal Stand-Up, and it's really easy to cut episodes for this. So easy that it's kind of amazing that other people aren't doing it, at least not yet. So go check that out. Listen to it on your way to work. Now, enough time has been wasted. Let's get into these 900s. 9, labor relations. 910, employee organizations. 9/11, participate, never forget, 9/11. Participation and membership in labor organizations. 9/11.1, right to participation. Each postal employee has the right, freely and without fear of penalty or reprisal, to form, join, or assist a labor organization or to refrain from any such activity. Each employee is protected in the exercise of such rights. Except as specified in 9/11.3, this right extends to participation in the management of the organization and acting as an organization representative. It includes presentation of the organization's views to officials of the Postal Service, officials of the executive branch, the Congress, or other appropriate authority. 9/11.2, right to membership. No interference, restraint, coercion, or discrimination to encourage or discourage membership in a labor organization may be effected in the Postal Service. 9/11.3, conflict of interests. Supervisors and certain other employees may not actively participate in the management of a labor organization, including voting in intra-union elections or acting as a representative of a labor organization when it would result in a conflict of interest or apparent conflict of interest, or otherwise be incompatible with law or with the official duties of the supervisor or employee. So this is going to come up. I've announced, at least softly, my candidacy. We'll make official announcements in our union meeting in October. But I've told people that I'm running for vice president, and they're like a 204B told me that, oh man, I really like you a lot more than the current guy. I'll for sure vote for you. But here it says, like, supervisors cannot vote in intra-union elections. It's a conflict of interest. And our own union bylaws would prohibit that as well. So I guess I can't count on that person's vote. But I ain't looking for supervisor votes anyway. Even if they are full-time carriers who happen to be temporary supervisors. Fooey on all of that. All right. Anyway, 9/11.4, Postal Service recognition. The Postal Service gives exclusive recognition to labor organizations that meet the requirements for such recognition under the provisions of the Postal Reorganization Act. And of course, for us, that would be the NALC. We are the only union that can represent carriers. 9/11.5, employee compensation during negotiations. Employees who represent a recognized labor organization are not on official time when negotiating a collective bargaining agreement with postal management. That must be why President Renfro has been dragging his feet, because he's not on official time. The post office isn't paying him to do that. No wonder it's taken so long. 920. Dues withholding for employee organizations. 921, voluntary withholding of dues. Employees who are members of supervisory, managerial, or labor organizations that have approved dues withholding agreements with the Postal Service may voluntarily authorize the Postal Service to withhold periodic dues from their salary payments. The organizations for which dues deductions are authorized include those encompassed by the provisions of the Postal Reorganization Act. 925, cancellation of dues withholding authorization. 925.1, voluntary cancellations. 925.11, form used. What I'm about to read is the way you go about canceling your union dues. And I am reluctant to read this because, of course, I don't want anybody to leave the union. But I think what's more important is to make the union good enough that people don't want to leave it. So I'm going to put my focus there, and this information, people have a right to know. 925.11, form used. Employees use PS Form 1188, cancellation of organization dues from payroll withholdings, to cancel dues withholding. 925.12, when employees can cancel. 925.121, general. An employee can cancel an SF 1187 only in accordance with the terms of the authorization form that the employee signs to initiate the dues withholding. 925.122, special circumstances. Special circumstances that alter the conditions for canceling dues withholding are as follows. Option A doesn't apply to us, so I'm going to skip it. B, an employee using the revised SF 1187 described in 924.12 may cancel only by submitting PS Form 1188 to the installation head and via certified mail to the organization's national office not more than 20 days and not less than 10 days before the anniversary date. PS Form 1188 must be date stamped upon receipt. It is this date that is used to determine if the cancellation quest... Maybe I don't want to read this. It is this date that is used to determine if the cancellation request was received in accordance with the above requirements. Example. Assume an anniversary date of December 1st. The employee signs and dates PS Form 1188 on November 10 and certifies that copy 3 of the form has been sent to the organization's national office by certified mail. To comply with the 20 and 10-day requirement specified above, the employee office must receive and date stamp Part B of the form between November 11th and November 21st. If the HRSSC, that's HR Shared Services, receives all three copies of PS Form 1188, the entire form is returned to the employee with the reason noted. The 20 and 10-day rule is a requirement of the revised FS 1187 that can be waived only by the union. So guys, it is not easy to stop paying your union dues. It's kind of amazing that people have done it. They must be really motivated to get out of the union. I know the people who I have talked to, almost without exception, have gotten out because of personal experiences where they felt they weren't being represented or where they weren't being treated fairly by the folks down at the union hall. And I, at least one at my station has said that if I'm elected, he will get back into the union. And so that'd be cool. I mean, we don't have very many scabs, but the one that I talked to had said that. So anyway, again, the union has an obligation to be a kind of union that people don't want to drop out of. See, an employee whose documented position is not within a recognized bargaining unit, such as a supervisor, but who is having dues withheld for a labor organization that is recognized as a bargaining agent, may voluntarily cancel the dues withholding authorization effective the first full pay period after the request for cancellation is received at the HRSSC. The PS Form 1188 should be annotated to reflect the employee's current job title and effective date. D. The SF-1187 of a non-career employee stays in effect for 180 days following termination, even though the Postal Service does not withhold dues, to allow the employee the option of continued withholding if the employee is rehired within that 180-day period. If a non-career employee wants to cancel dues withholding when rehired, he or she may do so within 10 days by submitting PS Form 1188. A non-career employee may also cancel dues withholding according to the 20 and 10-day requirement, i.e. not more than 20 days and not less than 10 days before the anniversary date. This anniversary date is the, quote, date of delivery to employer, end quote, of the SF-1187 originally authorizing dues withholding, and this date remains fixed regardless of the number of consecutive appointments. 925.2, discontinued withholding. 925.21, separation. The Postal Service discontinues dues withholding upon separation of any employee enrolled in the dues withholding program, although the process is modified for non-career employees. Dues withholding is discontinued for a non-career employee at the end of a term of employment, but the SF-1187 stays in effect for 180 days. If the employee is rehired within 180 days, the dues deduction restarts unless the employee submits a cancellation as specified in 925.122D. After 180 days, a rehired employee must complete another SF-1187 in order to activate dues withholding. 925.22, organization request. Withholding of dues is discontinued at any time upon written request from the organization for which the withholding is authorized. 925.3, cancellation notices. Cancellation notices must include the employee's name, date, dues deduction anniversary date, Social Security number, name and finance number of the installation where officially assigned, and name and alpha code of the organization involved. Guys, they do not make it easy. You know, maybe running for office and changing the union from within is actually easier than canceling your dues. Boy, if you are interested in making our union strong again, and like as Tyler Vassar says, building a fighting NALC, that seems like the better way to go, right? Let's just try to fix what we got. I mean, dude, I went through that in my own marriage where, you know, divorce is not pretty. Maybe we should just figure out a way to get our shit together and you know, be good to each other. And luckily that's what's happened. I've been married 16 years now and it's going pretty well. And yeah, I'm of the opinion that fixing things is better than chucking them out. And that is also true with our union. All right, 925.5, filing procedures. All SFs 1198 and PS Forms 1188 requiring a payroll adjustment are sent to the HRSSC for processing. The forms are files within the permanent documents in the employer's EOPF. That would be the official personnel file, I presume. 925.6, transfer or reassignment. When an employee who is having dues withheld for a management or labor union transfers or is reassigned to another postal installation, his or her dues withholdings are transferred to the local organization at the gaining installation. The dues amount remains the same unless otherwise changed by the new local organization. If a change in the dues amount is to be made, a request is submitted by the organization as provided in 924.62. However, such a request is limited to the employee involved. Okay, that's it with that touchy subject. Now we are going to move on to our uniform allowances. 930, work clothes and uniforms. 931, uniforms. 931.1, entitlement and allowances. 931.11, entitlement. Certain employees must wear prescribed uniforms in performing their duties. These employees are entitled to the following. A, a uniform allowance to purchase authorized uniform items. Or B, to be provided uniforms that meet Postal Service specifications. 931.2, purpose and scope. 931.21, uniforms. Uniforms are provided to certain employees for the following reasons. A, to provide immediate visual identification with the Postal Service to the public. You know, and this is a good reason why we should give uniforms, like a full set of uniforms to our brand new hires, because it's already hard enough doing the job. You're already kind of awkward. You don't know what you're doing. But then on top of that, you don't look like a letter carrier. And so that just adds another barrier. Like when you're going into businesses or, you know, just trying to get through your day. I know this is a bargaining point in the new contract, which hopefully will be settled soon, but we've been hoping that for a long time. So anyway, this is another good reason why we need to give new hires uniforms and not make them wait. B, to project an appearance to the public that is neat, professional, and pleasing. Dude, I know you guys have seen rural carriers in very casual clothing. C, to help develop in the employee a feeling of esprit de corps. D, to meet standard professional practices. 931.22, work clothes. Work clothes are provided to certain employees, A, who perform dirty work or work with toxic materials. B, when it is important that they be recognized and identified with the Postal Service, work clothes are provided for employees who work in public view. C, to certain full-time employees working full-time in areas where work clothing is essential. 931.23, personal appearance. Supervisors are responsible for continually observing the uniforms of employees and taking appropriate corrective action when necessary to ensure employees are properly attired. This is something that will come up from time to time in installations. They get a new postmaster or a new station manager, and they have a hard-on for uniforms. And now they want you to start wearing a necktie, or you can't wear short sleeve shirt with long pants, stuff like that. And we went through this in a previous section of the ELM, that there are standards to this effect. But man, does that help us do our job better? It's such a ticky-tack thing. And especially in the weather conditions that we have to work in, you know, it, like, I wear long pants and long sleeves in the summer because it's, the sun is so brutal. But if I had to wear a necktie and, like, cut off that ventilation, oh, dude, that'd be brutal. 931.24, administration of uniform policy. Items of uniform dress are listed in 933.1 through 933.6. These lists include all items to which allowances are applicable that employees in these categories may be required to wear under various circumstances. The lists do not mean that every employer is required to acquire and wear every one of the items at some time during the service in the category. On the contrary, the list for each of several categories contains a number of items that some employees in a particular category may never need to wear. It is the intent of these regulations that appropriate items for wear in matters of this kind be determined at the installations in accordance with collective bargaining agreements and Postal Service policy. You know, it's possible that I haven't actually talked to you guys about the uniform. It feels like I have. I don't know. If I haven't talked about it yet, I'm going to talk about it shortly. Because, dude, at this point, the ELM is all starting to run together. All right. 931.25, responsibility of installation heads. Installation heads, A, post a list of uniform items authorized for the installation. The list indicates those items that are required and those that are optional to the employee. B, enforce all uniform allowance regulations and prevent abuse. C, make all rules and regulations governing uniform clothing and accessory purchases readily accessible to all employees and vendors. So here this is where I would argue against a manager who wants to be really strict about uniforms. You know, are they doing A, B, and C here so that we know the uniform requirements, so that we're given time to purchase them, so that the vendors know? It makes it very hard for them to enforce these uniform rules if they're not meeting their own responsibilities. And by the time this all settles out, maybe you get a new supervisor in there, a new manager. 931.26, responsibility of employees. 931.261, appearance. Postal employees are responsible for being adequately and properly dressed for duty. They are expected to maintain high standards of appearance, representing to the public the best tradition of service and efficiency while performing their official duties. Uniform garments should be properly fitted and maintained in a clean, neat, and serviceable condition. Jeans, shorts, sleeveless tops, t-shirts, sweats, spandex, etc. are not appropriate attire for employees working at a retail counter. This list is not meant to be exhaustive. All right, so that's at the retail counter, like up at the window. That does not apply to carriers. 931.262, conforming with regulations. Uniformed employees are responsible for conforming with all uniform regulations. 931.263, when to wear uniforms. Uniforms are worn as follows. A, general. A uniform is worn only while the employee is on duty, in connection with approved activities directly related to postal employment. B, special authorization. Postmasters may authorize wearing postal uniforms for activities in which the Postal Service participates or which it sponsors, where identification with the Postal Service is beneficial to the service, and while the employee is traveling directly to and from work. C. Restrictions. In no other case may the postal employee's uniform or any part of it that identifies the garment or wearer with the Postal Service be worn in non-postal employment or activities. So guys, this means that if you go grocery shopping after work, you're not supposed to be in uniform. As a practical matter, you got to do what you got to do. And enforcement of this would be difficult for management. But I have heard of cases even here in Las Vegas recently where the station manager has started becoming strict about when you can wear your uniform. 931.264, Postal Service Emblem. The Postal Service emblem may not be worn except by uniformed postal employees as part of the prescribed uniform, except in the following circumstances. A. Postal and other installation heads may permit the voluntary wearing of the Postal Service emblem by a postal employee who has daily personal contact with the public, but who is not required to wear a uniform. That would probably be the case with like rural carriers. B. In all other situations, specific authorization is obtained through the administrative channels of labor relations. 931.27, employee acting as agent. No postal employee may act as agent directly or indirectly for any individual or firm engaged in the manufacture or sale of postal employees' uniform items. This is why, at least here, we have uniform vendors who are all retirees from the letter carrier craft. 931.28, payment for fabric. Guys, this is kind of cool. Payment is made for piece goods purchased for use in home sewing of items of uniform apparel authorized for the employee's craft. Reimbursement to the vendor is made in accordance with 936.5. Yes, you can buy fabric and sew your own uniforms. Isn't that something? Note the following. A. Payment is not made for purchases of piece goods for home sewing of any item that is not an authorized uniform garment for the craft concerned. And B. Fabric must meet specifications in 932.3. So yeah, you can sew your own uniforms. Just buy the fabric. Who knows if it would be cheaper? I'm really curious if anybody does that. It's not impossible, you know, especially if you have unusual sizes. That'd be kind of cool. Just get your hands on some of that old light blue material with the pinstripes on it and make yourself up a suit. 932.2, uniforms not required. 932.21, new, part-time, and casual employees. Unless uniforms have been provided to them, the following employees are not required to wear uniforms. A, new employees listed in 932.11. During the first 90 days of their employment, except for the prescribed uniform cap. Employees required to wear the uniform cap are reimbursed from uniform allowance funds for the cap. When the employee becomes eligible for full uniform allowance, the cost of the cap is charged against their first year allowance. B. Part-time employees with a regular or flexible work schedule, except for the cap, unless they meet the basic minimum hourly and daily requirements outlined in 932.11. C. Casual employees, except for the cap. So this is interesting because part-time employees is CCAs. And so it says part-time employees with a regular or flexible work schedule don't have to wear the uniform. Huh. Okay. Well, this is something you can fight over, right? And here's your citation. 933.12. Here is a chart. This is what I was thinking of earlier, is this chart that shows what combinations can be worn, what are allowable uniform combinations depending on the weather. So this is what I was thinking of earlier, because I do all this in advance and I take notes to talk to you guys about it. So it turns out, like, if you wear long pants and long sleeves in the winter, which is required, by the way, then you are also required to wear a navy blue tie. Women also require to wear a navy blue tie. And if management were to try to start enforcing stuff like this, like we've already talked about, you'd have to file maybe a past practice grievance where, dude, we've already been wearing our uniforms this normal way for a long time. Nothing bad has happened. Let's just, you know, leave it alone. 933.8, apparel worn for promotional purposes. Oh, and let me go back to this here. 933.12, it's interesting to look at what uniform items are available, what combinations they're supposed to be worn in. And even if you don't abide by it, it was an interesting read. I will say that. It was one of the more interesting charts in the ELM. All right, 933.8, apparel worn for promotional purposes. 933.81, authorized use. 933.811, uniformed employees. Only caps may be used as promotional items for uniformed employees, and they may be only used to promote Postal Service products or services. Designs must be consistent with the overall appearance of the uniform and must not contain extraneous decoration. The Senior Vice President of Marketing must approve the designs. The use of pins and other insignia must be controlled and should not be required for uniformed employees. Okay, so here we have these hats. Our uniform vendors have all these different hats. They got red hats, they have hats with different logos on them, they have hats made with different materials. And it seems like, based on my reading of 933.811, these could be considered promotional for the Postal Service and should be allowable. 934, wearing of uniform items. 934.1, uniform headgear. Oh, maybe it'll be discussed here. 934.11, optional wear. For the following employees, the wearing of uniform headgear is at the option of the employee. And there's A, B, C, whatever option, or item C is letter carriers. So for us, it is optional to wear headgear. 934.12, mandatory wearing of cap. Wearing of the cap is mandatory for A, casual employees, B, new employees who are not required to wear a uniform during the first 90 days of their employment, and C, all other employees who are authorized only a cap as a means of identifying them with the Postal Service. No substitute headgear may be worn by these employees. And so once again, we have this caveat here. No substitute headgear may be worn by these employees, which is an indicator that hats are flexible. Once you get uniform allowance and you're wearing your uniform, there's at least some flexibility in the hats that you can wear. 934.2, cold weather items. 934.21, face mask. In extremely cold climates, uniform employees who are regularly assigned outdoor duties for more than one half of the time may purchase a face mask as an optional reimbursable item. The face mask must be dark blue with no ornamentation in a wool blend or synthetic fabric. The use of this item shall be authorized by the installation head. This section does not apply to face masks that are part of the knit watch cap. 934.22, neck and chest protector. Employees authorized to wear the neck and chest protector as part of the cold weather uniform are not required to wear a necktie when the neck or chest protector is being worn to protect them from cold weather. However, employees must replace the protector with a tie if they work inside a postal facility and are in view of the public. Dude, these ties. So I actually used my uniform allowance once upon a time when uniforms were a lot cheaper and we had extra money to buy two neckties. One is a clip-on tie, the other one is a regular tie. And from time to time, I would wear those in the Carrier Academy to give the illusion of professionalism. But usually a half hour into the class, the illusion was utterly shattered and the tie became pointless. 934.23, sweaters. A sweater may be worn as an outer garment. When so worn, the official emblem is permanently attached. 934.24, outer garments. Only authorized outer garments are to be worn on the street during duty hours. Jacket liners may not be worn as outer garments, and only employees who choose or have chosen to purchase the related jacket may purchase them. So, just for clarification, you can't just buy the liner. You have to have the jacket with the liner. 934.3, warm weather items. and this does not apply to Type 2 uniforms. I think those are motor vehicle staff. 934.31, walking shorts and knee-length hose. Walking shorts may be worn only with blue-gray or white with blue-stripe crew socks, or blue-gray, white with blue-stripe, or black knee-length hose. So if you're going to wear shorts, you have to wear the approved socks. Dude, that, talk about nitpicky. Oh my goodness. Dude, I do not have socks like that, nor do I have the available uniform allowance to buy them. 934.32, summer shirt and tie. Wear a convertible collar, short or long sleeve summer shirt is authorized. The tie is not necessarily required. The tie must be worn whenever a jacket or coat is worn. Must. The tie must be worn whenever a jacket or coat is worn. Ah, dude, unbelievable. Can you believe the shenanigans they let us get away with? All these people not wearing ties out there? Man, we are a bunch of unprofessional bastards. Well, don't tell management. They probably never read this manual. After consulting with representatives of affected employees at the post office, if the postmaster decides a tie is to be worn with the convertible collared summer shirt, the tie is worn by all affected employees at the post office. However, if the decision is that a tie need not be worn, individual employees who desire to wear the tie may do so even though the majority are without ties. Oh, man. Dude, you really have to try to get me to wear a necktie in the summer when it's 115 degrees. 934.4, seasonal changes of uniform. The head of an installation determines when seasonal changes of uniforms take place, with the exception of retail employees. 934.6, prohibitions. Wearing postal uniforms is prohibited under the following circumstances. A, a person not connected with the letter carrier branch of the postal service who wears the uniform or badge worn by a city carrier is fined not more than $100 or imprisoned not more than 6 months or both. When employees are separated from the postal service, all emblems, buttons, or other identifying insignia must be removed before the uniforms are discarded. B, the uniform is not worn during or in connection with the furtherance of private employment or commercial interests. C, the uniform is not worn under circumstances that would tend to bring discredit upon the Postal Service. Like if you're running a back alley cockfighting ring, don't wear your postal uniform while you're taking all the bets. D, the uniform is not worn except when authorized by the postmaster or headquarters when an employee participates in activities such as public speeches, interviews, picket lines, marches, rallies, or any public demonstration that may imply service sanction of the cause for which the demonstration or activity is being conducted. So if you are doing a picket, for example, and protesting against the changeover to sorting and delivery centers, then you can't picket while you're in uniform. 935, uniform and work clothes allowances. 935.1, when allowances take effect. 935.11, anniversary date. Allowances take effect on the earliest date an employee is required to wear the uniform following completion of the 90-day probationary period. This date is known as the employee's anniversary date. For me, I got hired on January 21st, and my anniversary date is April 21st. 935.12, transfers. When employees who have been receiving allowances in one uniform category transfer or are reappointed to a different uniform category within the allowance year, they start a new anniversary date, provided they are eligible in the new category on the date of the assignment. 935.2, adjustment for certain absences during allowance year. 935.21, absences from uniform category of 90 days to 1 year. 935.211, policy. Employees temporarily assigned to light-duty assignments, OWCP absences, extended sick leave, or higher-level detail for a period of 89 days or more that does not require wearing a uniform have their uniform allowances suspended for the time they are on this assignment. 935.22, absences from uniform category exceeding 1 year. Employees on leave without pay in excess of a year or absent on military duty in excess of a year, who were eligible for uniform allowances immediately prior to their absence, receive a new anniversary date for uniform allowances directly on return to duty and pay status in a uniformed category. Other employees separated from a uniform category for periods in excess of 1 year are regarded as new employees and therefore entitled to the first year allowances when reassigned to a uniform category. So this may come up. If you have an employee who's out for a long time, maybe they're out on military leave and they come back, then they're, what did it say? They're, they get a new anniversary date from when they come back. 935.23, absences from duty while in uniform category. An employee on leave without pay, OWCP absence, extended sick leave, higher level detail, or military leave without pay, not in excess of 89 calendar days during a year of eligibility, receives full allowance if otherwise eligible. If such leave exceeds 89 calendar days, not necessarily consecutive but accumulated, during any uniform allowance year, the maximum allowance is reduced 10% for the 90 calendar days of leave without pay and 10% for each 30 days, for each full 30 calendar days of accumulated leave beyond the 90-day period. Recovery of earlier grants of allowance is not required, however, in achieving this reduction. So there's a good reason to spend your uniform allowance right away when you get it, because if you wind up missing a bunch of work, they're not going to try to recover what you've spent on uniforms. 935.24, reappointments. Employees who are separated from a uniformed category and are later reappointed to a position in the same category within 1 year have their allowance redetermined as outlined in 935.23 and retain their former anniversary date. 935.252 says that if it's more than a year, then you start over. You get a new anniversary date and you get the increased allowance. 936, payments. 936.1, limitations on payments. 936.11, total yearly payments. Total payments for an employee during an allowance year may not exceed the maximum allowance prescribed, except as indicated in 935.25. 936.12, insufficient funds for claims. Payment is not made for a purchase made in excess of an employee's yearly allowance. Employees must be particularly careful not to have merchandise invoiced before their anniversary date if the current year's allowance has been exhausted. And guys, I don't think this is covered in here, but as I understand it from our uniform vendors, any uniform funds that you don't use, they don't go back to the post office. Citibank actually just keeps that money. I don't know if that's true. That's what I've heard from more than one source. If you know the facts of the matter, by all means, let me know. classesmail@gmail.com. 936.13, related expenses. Payment is neither claimed nor made for expenses involved in the purchase of secondhand items of uniforms, nor for the cleaning, repairs, or alterations, except alterations made at the time of purchase for the sole purpose of ensuring proper fit. 936.14, items not specified. All branches of service have specific detailed specifications for the style and color of their particular uniforms. Detailed specifications and styles are prescribed for both male and female uniform items of clothing in each specific category of employment. Payment is neither claimed nor made for any items of clothing that do not conform with the detailed male or female specifications and styles for the employee's category of employment. 936.15, purchases exceeding allowances. I've done this many times where the allowance only goes so far and I need more shirts. Each employee is personally responsible to the authorized licensed vendor for all purchases exceeding his or her uniform allowance. In cases where employees purchase in excess of their full allowance or existing allowance balance, the full licensed vendor invoice is processed regardless of amount, even if records show a zero balance in the employee's allowance. The St. Louis ASC pays only the maximum left in employee's account and notifies the vendor why the remainder has not been paid. 936.3, approval by installation head. 936.31, inspection of purchases. The installation head may require the employee to present the uniform purchases for inspection within 10 working days from the receipt of the uniform item. An employee who is unable to comply with this requirement because of being in an approved leave status may present the purchased items for inspection upon return to a work status. All items must contain the certificate label issued by the Postal Service Quality Control Office, except as noted in 936.32. discretion is exercised in permitting the purchase of excessive amounts of one-of-a-kind items, such as shoes, gloves, socks, and other civilian-type items. So this happens when people are getting ready to retire, and maybe they like the postal shoes, so they'll buy a couple extra pairs of shoes, or they'll buy a bunch of extra socks or things like that that they can wear outside of their uniform. 936.32, purchases not meeting regulations. If all or a portion of the merchandise presented in 936.31 is unacceptable because it does not conform to current postal regulations, the employee is responsible for reviewing vendor invoices, returns the invoice to the vendor stating why it was unacceptable. The employee retains but does not wear the unacceptable merchandise and waits for instructions from the vendor. 936.33, disallowing payments. The district accounting office may disallow payment for excessively priced items. Dude, that would be like the entire catalog at this point. So excessively priced items, for items not needed for local climatic conditions, and for excessive amounts of civilian type items. 936.34, employees' responsibility for excesses. The installation head cautions all employees that uniform purchases exceeding their current allowances are the employee's personal responsibilities. 936.5, payment to licensed vendors. 936.51, payment is made directly to licensed vendors. 936.52, employee reimbursement. Employees are not reimbursed for uniform purchases except for caps, and as provided in 936.6 and 938.4. 937.2, access to postal premises. Postmasters may permit a licensed vendor for official postal uniform items access to postal installations and their sub-installations as follows. A, licensed vendors or their representatives must present proper identification to postmasters or their designated representatives. B, the location must have a lunchroom or other non-work area space of sufficient size so that vendors and interested employees may conduct their business without interfering with postal activities. Vendors must strictly adhere to local rules as to location, hours, etc., as required by local postmaster. D. Vendors failing to meet requirements in 937.2, items A and C may be denied admission by the postmaster. 939, authorized exceptions. Guys, if you have jacked up feet, this is for you. 939.1, footwear. 939.11, standard specification. Employees purchasing footwear under the uniform and work clothes programs must ensure that the footwear meets Postal Service standard specifications and bears the SR/USA label. So the way this is worded, employees purchasing footwear under the uniform and work clothes program must ensure that footwear meets the standard specifications and has that logo. So does this mean that if you are using your own money, then it doesn't have to have that label? Because in that case, if I'm spending my own money to buy my shoes, then I'm not purchasing it under the uniform and work clothes program. I'm purchasing it on my own. It's an argument. You know, you still have requirements that are laid out that they have to be black, leather, or leather-like, and non-slip. But the shoes that I wear come from New Balance because they're the only ones that make them wide enough. And they are non-slip, but they don't have that tag. So I don't know. This is, you know, it says, again, you're purchasing it under the uniform and work clothes program. If you're going outside of that program, then you shouldn't have to have that. 939.12, exceptions. Footwear must be purchased from a Postal Service licensed vendor. However, exceptions to the certified footwear program may be granted when appropriate. For example, medical reasons, very unusual sizing restrictions. And then it's under the following guidelines. A, employees must submit their request for exception in writing with appropriate supporting documentation to the district human resources manager. The employee's request, whether approved or not, must be filed in his uniform folder. B, when authorization is granted to purchase footwear from other than a Postal Service vendor, employees must present an itemized invoice to the uniform clerk at their facility. Invoices must include the name of the employee, the name of the firm from which the purchase was made, the date of purchase, the post office finance number, the employee's anniversary date, the employee's social security number, an itemized description of the items purchased, including size and color, and a statement by the employee certifying that the items listed were actually purchased. C. Installations process the purchase in the same manner as a vendor invoice, except that 81886 is used for the vendor number. This provides payment to the employee. So yes, this means the post office will pay for your shoes if you can't wear regular postal approved shoes. For example, I have these big ass Fred Flintstone. Well, they're not big, they're just wide. I have these wide Fred Flintstone feet. I wear a size 6E. And I used to be able to get 4E, which was close enough, from New Balance, but New Balance is no longer an authorized postal vendor. So I have to buy them myself from outside vendors. And this means if I get like a doctor's note that says I need these wide shoes, I can buy them, provide my invoice to the postal service, and the postal service will actually pay for those shoes. So that's pretty cool. That's helpful. Oh my God, you guys. Next is 940, the Employee Assistance Program, and this is the last section of the ELM. Holy crap. 940, Employee Assistance Program. 941, Introduction. 941.1, Purpose. 941.11, General. The Employee Assistance Program is a formal, voluntary, non-disciplinary program designed to assist employees and their immediate families in their efforts to resolve personal issues that may impact adversely on work performance, personal well-being, or both. Issues may include, but are not limited to, A, substance abuse, B, mental health issues such as depression, anxiety, and stress, and C, issues that involve family, marital, financial, and legal concerns. Assistance is provided through A, consultation, B, evaluation, counseling, and C, referral to community resources and treatment facilities. 941.12, Substance Abuse, Dependence, and Other Addictions. Substance abuse, dependence, and other addictions are serious health problems that can adversely affect an employee's job performance and personal life. They can even stop you from showing up for contract negotiations. Oh, that's not in the ELM, but it's implied. The EAP continues the Postal Service's obligation under its collective bargaining agreements to provide a program for employees with these problems. EAP is not intended to alter or amend any of the rights or responsibilities of the Postal Service or its employees. 941.3, Policy. 941.31, Job Security. Participation in EAP is voluntary and will not jeopardize the employee's job security and or promotional opportunities. 941.32, Limits to Protection. Although an employee's voluntary participation in EAP counseling should be given a favorable consideration in disciplinary action, participation in EAP does not limit management's right to proceed with any contemplated disciplinary action for failure to meet acceptable standards of work performance, attendance, or conduct. Participation in EAP does not shield an employee from discipline or from prosecution for criminal activities. It does not guarantee that you won't be disciplined from management, but I want to read this first part again. An employee's voluntary participation in EAP counseling should be given favorable consideration in disciplinary action. So if you're going through hard times and it's messing up your work life, check out EAP. You know, it can grant you some, as they call it, favorable consideration. 941.33, Confidentiality. Inquiries regarding participation in EAP counseling are confidential pursuant to the provisions of 944.4. EAP records may not be placed in an employee's official personnel folder. 941.34, Reasonable Access. The contractor providing counseling must endeavor to provide confidential counseling facilities within a reasonable driving distance from the employee's work site or home in accordance with the following guidelines. A, the Postal Service will provide office space and furnishings for those sites that require counselors to be in postal locations. B, providing ready accessibility to face-to-face EAP counseling is desirable but not always possible. Counselors may offer telephone counseling or request that the employee travel to the counselor's office. C, reasonable hours and days, including coverage of all three tours, will be set by mutual agreement between the EAP consultant and the human resources manager. D, counselors may adjust their schedules to respond to crisis situations and to meet other needs, such as providing information sessions and visiting facilities. 941.35, Scheduling. The following guidelines apply to scheduling and whether EAP sessions take place on or off the clock. A, an employee's first visit to EAP is on the clock, whether the visit is initiated by management, the union representative, or the employee, unless the employee prefers to visit the EAP unit on his or her own time. Guys, you heard that right. Not only does the post office cover this benefit, but you can go to meet your EAP counselor on the clock. B, subsequent consultations are on the employee's own time. C, if a reasonable period of time has elapsed since a management referral or a previously disclosed self-referral, the manager or supervisor may, on a case-by-case basis, approve an additional on-the-clock session. Oh, that's nice. You get another session on the clock if you seem like you need it. D, to receive pay for an on-the-clock session, the employee must authorize the EAP provider to disclose his or her attendance to management. So they don't talk about like what you're discussing. They just can tell them, yes, the employee was there. And so, yeah, you're doing what you're supposed to do. 942, program elements. 942.1, education. EAP counselors and subcontract counselors must provide information, training, or both periodically for all Postal Service employees to inform them about EAP services and the kinds of personal problems that can affect job performance or conduct. 942.2, problem identification, referrals, and evaluation. 942.21, patterns of behavior and work performance problems. Certain patterns of behavior and or work performance can be indicative of problems affecting an employee. Deterioration in attendance, appearance, conduct, ability, or any combination of these factors may signal that the employee is experiencing a personal problem that may affect his or her job performance. These problems may include depression, anxiety, gambling, emotional stress, and marital problems, as well as substance abuse, dependence, or other addictions. 942.22, referrals to EAP. 942.221, management referrals. If a supervisor or manager observes any of the patterns listed in 942.21 or has some other reason to believe that the EAP could provide needed assistance to an employee, he or she may refer the employee to the EAP. Since participation is voluntary, the employee has the option to refuse the referral and cannot be disciplined for noncompliance. Exception. If an employee has signed a last chance or settlement agreement that requires EAP participation, the employee can be disciplined for noncompliance under the terms of the agreement. 942.222, referrals from others. Fellow employees, union representatives, management association representatives, medical personnel, family members, or judicial and social service agencies may refer employees to the EAP. However, if any of these suggest or recommend that the employee seek EAP assistance, participation is always voluntary. 942.223, self-referrals. Employees who want help with any personal problem or concern are encouraged to seek assistance directly by personally contacting the EAP. 942.244, EAP response. The following requirements apply. EAP counselors must accept all referrals. Face-to-face or telephone interview appointments must be available within a reasonable period from the time the request is made by the employee or family member. Face-to-face and telephone appointments for urgent situations must be made consistent with need, regardless of the counselor's regularly scheduled hours. Crisis counseling must be available by telephone 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. 942.23, problem evaluation. EAP counseling staff provides assessment services and arranges counseling for employees or family members or refers them to appropriate treatment resources. 942.3, recovery counseling and resources. 942.31, EAP counseling sites. EAP sites are staffed by EAP professionals trained to provide assessment, short-term counseling, and referral services to individuals who seek their assistance. Postal Service EAP sites are not equipped to provide detoxification or drug rehabilitation assistance, but they can make referrals to outside programs and treatment facilities for these problems. To provide convenient, ready access to EAP counseling services for all Postal Service employees and their family members, a network of similarly qualified and capable affiliate counselors is available to provide EAP counseling services at other locations. 942.32, residential and community resources. EAP counseling service providers. EAP counseling service providers. Maintain information about a variety of outside programs, treatment facilities, and resources available to employees and family members. Provide assistance with initial arrangements and appointments. The cost of these programs or treatment facilities is borne by the employee or the employee's health insurance. In cases for which hospitalization or detoxification is recommended, the employee is responsible for requesting sick leave, leave without pay, annual leave, or advanced sick leave. 942.4, follow-up. 942.41, progress. If a manager or supervisor has referred an employee to EAP counseling because of a job performance problem, that manager or supervisor shall continue to monitor the employee's job performance. 942.42, discontinuation or discontinuance of participation. Whether an employee opts to continue or discontinue participation in EAP counseling, he or she is responsible for maintaining prescribed job performance standards. 942.43, return to work. If an employee is on leave from the Postal Service to participate in an outside rehabilitative program for mental health or substance abuse issues, the EAP counselor may, upon the employee's request and authorization, monitor the course of rehabilitation and assist in any contemplated return to work. 943, reinstatement of recovered employees. 943.1, policy. 943.11, consideration of request. Managers should give serious consideration to a request for reinstatement from a recovered employee because the experience gained during the previous postal employment could be a valuable asset to the Postal Service. So, yet another reason you should go through the EAP. If you wind up getting fired, then they should consider giving you your job back. And guys, this is it. This is the last one. 944.422, limitation of confidentiality. If an employee who is an EAP counseling participant reveals the commission or intended commission of serious criminal activity, the EAP counselor is not prohibited from disclosing that information so long as the employee is not identified as an EAP counseling program participant. Confidentiality does not apply in any of the following cases. A. A crime is committed on EAP premises or against EAP counselor personnel, or a threat to commit such a crime is made. B. Incidents occur in which information must be reported as required by state law. For example, mandatory reporting of C. Child abuse and or neglect, and elder or spouse abuse in some cases. D. For a disclosure that may be required by elements of the criminal justice system because they have referred employees who are EAP participants. And this is the same sort of thing that regular counselors have to do. There are plenty of people out there who are mandatory reporters, and your EAP counselors are no different. Guys, and with that, we did it. These notes that I'm reading from span 159 pages, 43,000 words of notes, and we got through them. Dude, good job, us. I look forward to season 4. Now I have to record a few more episodes of my other podcast, The Postal Stand-Up, and get those in the can so they can keep coming out. Oh my goodness, guys. Thank you for coming through with me. Thank you for listening to all this. It's been really valuable to learn. And we are now going to move on to season 4, where we talk about our union and how we treat each other. So thanks for listening, guys. I will see you next season.